It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this morning?
No, she's out sick. We hope she'll be back next week.
And we don't think it's the swine flu.
We're pretty sure of that, no.
No. All right.
She's
both play doctors on TV.
Yes, and she's more of a cow person anyway.
Yeah, yeah, for those that know her.
She grew up on a dairy farm, so.
There you have it. All right. Well, as we do regularly, and more as you do regularly in Eat the State, you do an election recommendations.
Yeah, and ballots are due to show up any moment now for a lot of people.
I got mine this week.
Yeah, they went out in the mail at the end of the week. So we do this every year for both the primary and the general election, where we go through and tout our picks, as it were, with the understanding that medical studies have shown that even secondhand exposure to voting can be hazardous to your health. But for those people who insist on this radically self-destructive behavior, we do try to give some suggestions as to the folks that we think most reflect the values that you hear on this program and, you know, share the concerns, some of the concerns that we have, and pass on what we know about some of these folks, and with the caveats that we always put forward, that, you know, this is basically our opinions, and, you know, nothing more nor less than that, and you know, take it for what it's worth, and look at other people's opinions and do your own research.
Yes, and always think for yourself.
Always think for yourself, and don't
please.
And don't you dare take at face value everything that we tell you, because, you know, sometimes we're just making it up.
Okay. Well, with that admission, let's dive in. We're only going to do part of it this week.
That's right. We want to wait until Maria gets back next week before we take on the Seattle mayor's race and King County executive and the city and county council races, since those are those include some of the races that are potentially more contentious, and maybe that Maria might have a couple of different opinions than I might. And we want to give you a fuller range of ideas, of considerations, of things to take into account for some of those races, especially, I think, Seattle mayor. Because that's one that is flummoxing an awful lot of people.
All right, so we are going to start with initiatives. Is that right?
Yeah, there's only three of them on the ballot this year, and they're all actually very straightforward and very. There's not much ambiguity on any of these. The first is I-1033, which is Iman's latest, and out of his decade of initiatives, it may be the most destructive and most irresponsible ballot measure that he's ever put forward, and that's an awfully high bar, but. It is in fact the truth. What I-1033 would do would constrain not only states but also counties and cities from ever expanding their annual budgets beyond the baseline that exists now. That is to say, in the middle of the worst economic downturn in generations, except for a formula that is based on the rate of inflation plus the expansion of the population, which sounds reasonable until you realize that because government services involve usually trained professional services, because there aren't ways that you can build in efficiencies the way you can in private business, because, you know, you have to have teachers in order to teach classes, you have to have law enforcement officers in order to patrol the streets, and you know, there's just no way you can do that with fewer people and more productivity. So those costs tend to rise at a higher rate than inflation. So what this is basically is a prescription for ever shrinking government, and a prescription that would essentially every time that there's a downturn in the economy would reduce taxes further. In fact, the state budget office estimates that if you take it out far enough, that it would eventually reduce property taxes to zero. That is to say, there would be no such funding, and governments at all levels would be reliant on whatever other revenue streams they could scrap forward. It's really, really destructive. I mean, if you want schools without any teachers, if you want law enforcement without any police officers, if you want no environmental protection, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then 1033 is for you. But it is a grossly irresponsible measure, and you know, don't take my word for it, because they passed a similar measure in Colorado a few years ago, and they actually wound up repealing it after a few years because it was so destructive to the state's economy and so disruptive to the state's government that even conservatives there, most of them anyway, realized that it was an enormous mistake, and it wound up being repealed. But that hasn't stopped Tim Iman, and so it's on the ballot, and so hopefully people won't be taken in by the fact that on the surface it looks like it's a reasonable suggestion, because it's not. It's intentionally deceptive, and it's nasty.
All right. What else? What other initiatives are on our?
We have Referendum 71, which is the measure that's been put on the ballot. And of course, this was forced onto the ballot by anti-gay activists. But the way you have to vote for this is voters have to approve the civil union, essentially the marriage in all but name. Bill that was passed by the legislature last spring that confers on all couples, heterosexual as well as homosexual, who are not legally married, the same rights in terms of state law as married couples enjoy. You have to vote for this in order to extend those rights to non-married couples. And, you know, since there's two different issues with marriage, there's marriage in terms of what churches recognize, and you know, churches being private entities are free to marry or not marry whoever they want, but there's also marriage in terms of what government recognizes and the various rights and responsibilities that all levels of government extend to different people based on whether they are or are not married. And that shouldn't have anything to do with what various organized religions do or do not recognize as legitimate. That should be equal rights for everyone. And so it's a very progressive, forward-thinking piece of legislation that is long overdue that the state legislature enacted. And the people who are opposed to it are by and large people who are alarmed that adultery and fornication and divorce and all those other things are just fine as long as they're between a man and a woman, but as long as you get two guys together or two women together, well, you know, that somehow threatens the sanctity of marriage. The best suggestion for them, I think, is that if they don't want to sleep with somebody of the same gender, don't do it, but don't stop those of us who do.
All right, so you're proposing people vote...
Vote yes on that, because yes is in favor of enacting the law. No would repeal it.
All right, and then finally, Seattle Proposition 1.
Proposition number 1 is the housing levy. This comes up every 7 years. It's a 7-year extension of an existing levy that is really very critical in terms of providing low and moderate income housing for people who cannot afford market rate housing in Seattle. It helps out with all sorts of different programs to help people in an economy where and a housing market where people really still do struggle very often to find appropriate housing. So it's really essential that this be passed. So a very strong yes on Proposition 1, which is the housing levy.
All right. Then that takes us over to the Port of Seattle races.
Yeah, there's 3 of the 5 Port of Seattle commissioner races are up for grabs this time. In position number 1, John Creighton, who is the president of the Port of Seattle, is unopposed. And just on general principle, ETS doesn't take a stance on races where people are unopposed because, you know, we weren't particularly fond of the Soviet Union and we aren't, or North Korea or any place else where sham elections are held that ratify official party incumbents, so we don't see any reason to do that here. I will say that Creighton is not as bad as some of the other corporate shill apologists that the port has had in the past. He has been open to some reforms, but he has generally been a pro-business commissioner who has sided with the forces trying to stifle reform there. So I would not particularly be interested in ratifying his coronation. But there are 2 reform candidates that are on the ballot in positions number 3 and 4, Rob Halland and Max Bekich. Are the 2 people to vote for. They're actually running on something of a slate against 2 very pro-business, pro-corporate welfare type of candidates, who I'm not even going to dignify by mentioning their names. So Rob Halland and Max Bekich are the Port Commission races. candidates to vote for.
For position 3 and 4.
Position 3 and 4. That is correct.
All right. Then that takes us on to the Seattle School District.
And in Seattle School District, we have only two contested races here. We have District Number 5. Mary Bass is the incumbent there. This district is the central district and the central and eastern part of the city. She has been the representative there for some time. She really is the only person left over from the reform slate that was elected several years ago over the course of a couple different election cycles. And she's done a very good job over the years and has been very well connected with her community. And as usual this time around, she's being targeted by the kind of downtown interests that are now dominating the school district. But she is she's done a good job, and she is a voice for viewpoints and concerns that are otherwise not very well heard on the school board right now. So a very strong endorsement for Murray Bass for school district position number 5.
Right.
And then on position number 7 is the other position, and this is an open seat. Betty Patu, I believe that's how it's pronounced, P-A-T-U, is the best of the two candidates here. She has a number of endorsements from progressive local politicians. She also has quite a bit more experience in regards to the school district and schools in general than her opponent seems to, and we tend to agree more with her viewpoints, too. So it's always a bit of a crapshoot when you're talking about open seats, but we want to go with Betty Patu.
All right, and then finally for today, we have the King County Assessor's position.
The King County Assessor's position has several different candidates vying for it, 5, I believe, in total. But the one we want to go with is Lloyd Hara, who is trying to move over to this position from his Port of Seattle commission position. Now, at the Port of Seattle, he has been, you know, not perfect, but generally a pretty good voice for reform at the port, and he's done a pretty good and pretty conscientious job. He's certainly been responsive and open to community concerns and activists that have come to see him about different issues. So we think he would be good also in his bid to replace Scott Noble, the disgraced DUI former King County assessor. So it's an open seat because Noble is not running for re-election, and we are backing Lloyd Hara, H-A-R-A.
All right. So that's going to do it for this week for the election wrap-up. And
yeah, we will come back with the City and County Council and the King County Executive and the Seattle City Mayor next week. And in the meantime, if you're curious or you want to fill out your ballot before then, go check each state's website, and you'll see the full article of endorsements. It's at www.eatthestate.org. And we'll repeat that at the end of the show.
You want to get those answers ahead of time.
Absolutely.
All right.
You're going to cheat on the test.
Well, that's one of the problems with the internet, isn't it? All right. Let's move on to other related news this week, starting with local and an update regarding Referendum 71.
Yeah, we've been tracking the court struggles over efforts by a pro-Referendum 71 activist to try and get copies of the signatures on the petitions by which the anti-gay activists had qualified Referendum 71 for the ballot. Initially, a federal judge in Tacoma had issued an injunction that prevented enabled the signature gatherers to refuse to release those signatures, even though state law would normally require it. A federal court in California, the Ninth Circuit court panel, overturned that ruling this week and ordered Referendum 71 opponents to release those signatures. Now, Tim Iman has also gotten into the act, and both he and Referendum 71 opponents have vowed to appeal that ruling to the full Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and so there probably won't be a full ruling on the issue until after the election, at which point most of it becomes moot. Above and beyond that, Iman wants to protect the signatures that he has gathered over the past 10 years or so for his various initiatives. So this is looking like it's going to become something of a test court case, which determines whether, as the Referendum 71 opponents and Iman are arguing, the signature gatherers or the signatures on petitions to qualify an issue for the ballot are analogous to a vote, and it's a private expression of support by a citizen, or whether it's a public document and therefore subject to public disclosure rules.
All right. Well, speaking of public disclosure, the PDC weighing in. Actually, they're starting to get kind of busy at this time of year.
Yeah, there are always a number of PDC complaints by various campaigns against their opposing campaigns this time of year, and most of those are pretty minor and usually don't get ruled on until well after the election. And so, you know, unless there's a minor fine or something like that, usually they're not of much consequence except for the publicity they generate. But there was a major one this week. It was a complaint that was filed by King County Democrats against Susan Hutchison, the arch-conservative, supposedly nonpartisan candidate for King County Executive. She apparently, in her latest filing, neglected to report how she is paying for an extremely expensive house that they are renting in Laurelhurst and using as their campaign headquarters. Similar houses in the neighborhood are renting for anywhere from between $2,500 and $4,000 a month, and the expense simply doesn't show up anywhere on her her campaign disclosures. Yeah, it's either got to be an in-kind donation or she's got to be spending it somehow. Now, it turns out through a front company, the house is the landlord is a front company that is owned by telecommunications mogul Bruce McCaw, who has already double maxed out on his contributions to Susan Hutchison. Both he and his spouse have given her, and I presume his spouse is female because Hutchison is that kind of a person. They have given her the maximum amount allowed by law. So any kind of an in-campaign donation would, by definition, be illegal. The Hutchison campaign is claiming that the house is actually the residence of her campaign manager, which, since her campaign manager is a 20-something kid from California, seems kind of ludicrous on the face of it. And then Hutchison, when she was asked about this at a press conference yesterday, was claiming, well, it was simply an administrative oversight, as were the tens of thousands of dollars in unaccounted for expenditures by the campaign, so which would be enough to pay, for example, for an entire mass mailing. So if this is unintentional, it doesn't speak well to Hutchison's executive ability, which of course is at what she wants the job for as King County Executive. And if it is intentional, it's a very serious violation of, or even if it's not intentional, it's a very serious violation of campaign law.
I thought she'd actually come out publicly saying she was supportive of Referendum 71, but I could be wrong on that. So, all right, moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, we had some interesting things going on locally this week. While much of Wall Street is booming, regional banks that are much more closely tied to consumers and lending, you know, direct lending to consumers, whether they be private lenders or commercial lenders, those folks are still hurting. And we had an excellent example of that here this week. Sterling Savings Bank, the second largest bank in Washington State, was told by regulators to shrink its portfolio of problem loans and raise at least $300 million in new capital. This is for a bank that the stock market only values at less than $68 million total right now. So it's a very tall order. Financial analysts are saying that there are some dozen Washington State banks that are at strong risk of failing by mid-2010, and you'd have to put Sterling Savings and its subsidiary Gulf Savings, which is in Snohomish County, on that list, that they are in trouble. Sterling Savings, incidentally, got $303 million in TARP funds last December, so they were a recipient of bailout funds by the government last year, but it still hasn't helped them. The reason it hasn't helped them is that Sterling has much of its portfolio in small commercial loans. The Seattle metro area has the nation's highest delinquency rate for construction and land loans in the second quarter, some 32.7%. That's four times the rate of 2008, the same period in 2008. So that's where Sterling has a lot of its money, and they are definitely hurting badly. That's something that extends to several other local banks as well, and obviously it's an indicator that consumers and small businesses and types of folks that are doing, for example, real estate development are not sharing in the boom time recovery and the big executive bonuses that people like Goldman Sachs are enjoying right now.
Well, maybe we should start a pool on how many banks people expect to fail by the end of the year.
Well, there have already been a number in Washington State and well over 100 nationally. So it would probably not attract the attention of your average football fantasy league, but it would definitely be competitive.
Mm. All right, moving on to international and an intriguing story of late from Robert Fisk.
Yeah, more economic news, actually. A story by Robert Fisk in the Independent UK this week that a variety of Gulf states, as well as China, Russia, Japan, India, and Brazil, have been holding secret meetings to formulate a plan that would eliminate the U.S. dollar as the main form of currency in international oil transactions. This is something that came up several years ago when Saddam Hussein was threatening to take his oil sales for Iraq off of the dollar and onto the euro. And there was a lot of speculation at the time that that was one of the motivations for the Bush administration going ahead and invading Iraq and deposing his government. Iran has made similar noises around its oil sales as well. And that also, again, correlates to threats by the Bush administration and as well as the continuing threats of sanctions by the United States under President Obama to isolate and potentially to take military action against Iran as well. This is something the United States is very, very much afraid of, that the dollar would no longer be the currency in which oil is traded internationally. Seeking to switch from the dollar to a collection of other currencies such as the yen, yuan, which is the Chinese currency, the euro, and the gold as a forthcoming unified currency that will be used by a number of Gulf states. That's what the negotiations are all about. And the plan, according to Fisk, would be to make the switch over for all of these countries, including China, Russia, and some of the emerging countries by the year 2018. Now that would mean that most of the oil sales in the world would be either in this mixture of currencies or in the euro, and the dollar would be left out in the cold, and that would cause all kinds of different foreign trade and valuation problems for the dollar and for the United States economy.
All right. Moving on to while we're hearing about that the Obama administration had just increased the number of troops to Afghanistan, you've read that perhaps there's been some more increases.
Yeah, quite separate from the proposed increase by General McChrystal, which the Obama administration is still weighing. The Washington Post reporting this week that he is that Obama, in the wake of his Nobel Peace Prize, quietly deployed another 13,000 non-combat troops to Afghanistan. These are support troops that do things behind the lines. And, you know, some of that would be into non-military missions that have to do with civil aid, but much more of it has to do with the military mission, and really underscores the idea that any kind of a drawdown in Afghanistan, despite some of the media coverage to the contrary, is not on the table. And the only question really is going to be how much of an increase in American military presence there will be in Afghanistan and how quickly that presence will ratchet up. Even though, again, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of strategy and a whole lot of an end game to any of this. Right. And of course, we saw this past week also the eighth anniversary of the original invasion of Afghanistan. And as we will get to when we go through this week's events in a couple of minutes, there's another march today commemorating that anniversary to try and protest the war in Afghanistan.
Okay. Well, that moves us on then to news from Honduras.
Yeah, we've been following that for a while, of course. Last week, diplomats from the United States and other Western Hemisphere countries basically inserted themselves in the process whereby President Zelaya, who's been holed up since last month in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, those diplomats insisted that Zelaya and the military junta that now controls the country start talking in order to resolve the impasse. Those talks are now at a stall, Zelaya claiming that the junta has been intransigent. They are insisting that the impasse be resolved by the Supreme Court, which was the body that originally issued an arrest warrant for Zelaya. And of course, the pressure that's been exerted by the Obama administration on this is somewhat undercut by the fact that a number of Republicans, as well as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and some of the more hawkish Democrats, have all kinds of ties to and interest with some of the coup leaders. So it's still messy down there.
All right. And Zimbabwe.
Yeah, we talked quite a bit over this past year about the disputed elections in Zimbabwe. At the beginning of this year, they after much bloodshed, they had finally resolved some sort of a unity government. It looks like that government is falling apart. Morgan Tsvangirai, the the opposition leader who had been sharing the top post with Robert Mugabe. He and his party, that is Tsvangirai and his party, withdrew from the unity government this week after Mugabe went ahead and proceeded with prosecution of a top Tsvangirai aide for basically fake charges stemming from that unrest early this year, charging that that aide was trying to foment overthrow of the government. So Zimbabwe also looks like it may be heading for certainly more political troubles and maybe more violence as well. And once again, Robert Mugabe seems to be the center of the problem.
All right, then that takes us to events for this week.
Yeah, several things going on this week, both today and tomorrow. The first ever, at least in Seattle, Anarchist Book Fair is happening at the Underground Event Center, 2407 First Avenue between Battery and Wall in Belltown. There will be a number of workshops as well as, of course, books. That will be going on today from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and tomorrow from 11 until 6:30. Also today, as I mentioned earlier, there will be a march and rally in opposition to the war in Afghanistan. That will be at 1 o'clock today, starting at SCCC, Seattle Central Community College, at Broadway and Pine. Folks will be marching downtown via the International District, so hopefully the rain will hold off. And there will be a rally afterwards at Westlake Park, that's 4th and Pine. And then tomorrow, an issue we haven't talked about a whole lot in this program yet, but we're certainly keeping an eye on. Travis Bishop and Leo Church, two GI resistors that are currently imprisoned in Fort Lewis, and they've been held basically incommunicado by the military in contravention to the rules of the military justice system. They haven't been allowed access to their attorneys. They haven't been allowed access to their families and so forth. There's going to be a rally in support of them tomorrow from 3 to 6 p.m. at the overpass outside the front gate of Fort Lewis. That's I-5 exit 122 Berkeley Avenue between 3 and 6 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
All right. Well, talking as we do every week with Jog Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State, and tell people where they can find Eat This State.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, this is the election issue that we have every year, and it's probably our most popular issue of the year because for some reason people like to make fun of our picks or something. I'm not entirely sure. But you can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, etc. You can also find the election endorsements and the rest of our fine issue on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Of course, we are always looking for volunteers, for distributors, particularly in the south half of the city. We've lost a number of distributors in recent months and could use some more volunteers. We are also looking for somebody to be a distribution coordinator. And we've got a fundraiser coming up, which we'll be talking about more about in coming weeks. On November 13th, Friday night, save that date.
Friday the
13th. And I'm almost kind of reluctant to admit this on the air, but I turned 50, and so folks are having a roast of me, which is either a brilliant idea or something I'm really going to regret.
Doesn't give us a lot of time to fatten you up.
Yeah, exactly. But that's going to be at University Baptist Church on Friday night, November 13th, and it should be a lot of fun. And we'll have some good speakers and some probably, from my standpoint anyway, quite humiliating proceedings. So
is that going to be a black tie affair?
I sincerely doubt it. So anyway, mark that date on your calendar, and we'll have more information on that in coming weeks.